them, and that those are House bills 2225, 2234, 2236, 2237. So I'll open a public hearing on all of those. We have but one witness, Ronell Shank. And then committee will go to 3051, will be the next one. And we can't go into work session on that until we hear from Representative Morrissey. So, but he had to go back to the ground to call. There on the floor. Yeah, we have a new face with us today, someone who's spent all his time on the House side and on the criminal side of the House Judiciary, and he's just delighted to be here, John Horton. So he's given me an excellent summary, so I really appreciate that. Why don't we take the bills in numerical order, and you can address the one, you're the only witness, and then close the public hearing, go into work session, go on to the next.
Okay. I can begin. For the record, I'm Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division, here today representing the state agencies of the Oregon Child Support Program, which is both the Department of Human Resources Adult Family Services Section, where the Program Director's Office resides, and the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division. The first bill today before you on behalf of the Child Support Program is House Bill 2225. There are two basic concepts in this bill. The bill as originally drafted deals with the concept of how we distribute child support payments that are received or collected. In essence, this bill says that we wish to have laws that say we will draft rules that mirror the federal regulations at any point in time with regard to how we distribute child support payments in Oregon. The second part of this bill, the second concept, you will find in the Angross, and that was another concept amended in on the House side that has to do with unclaimed funds and the statute regarding turning unclaimed funds over to Division of State Lands if they are not able to be applied for 2 years. This bill says that while we would continue to report any unclaimed funds to the Division of State Lands so that we would meet the requirements of those statutes and they would be able to use their processes already in place, we would not actually transfer the child support money. We would leave it in the child support account. The reason behind that is if we transfer money out of the child support account over to state lands, the federal government considers that income of the state of Oregon at the point that we transfer it, and they take their portion of the money back out since the child support program is partially funded by the federal government. Those are the two basic concepts in this particular bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And you're in favor of the Dash 8 3 amendments?
For variant A3, are those conflict amendments?
Yes.
Then I would be in favor of those.
All right. Any questions? If not, we'll close the public hearing, open the work session on the House Bill 2225.
Amendment 2224.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Moves to Dash A3 amendment. Discussion? Objection, so ordered.
Bill 2225, floor is amended, declares due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2225 as amended before due pass. Discussion, objection, so ordered. Carrier, please.
Okay. You want to carry it, Vern? Is that what you're about to do?
Vern Duncan will go.
I would defer to you.
No, go. You got to start carrying your load around here, huh?
Now open a public hearing on House Bill 2234. Pernell.
Again, for the record, Ronell Schenkel, Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division, here today on behalf of the state offices within the program. 2234 is a bill that we're calling our caretaker relative bill. Our cases often work for the child support program in which a child or children are not in the physical custody of either parent, but are in the custody of some other relative, perhaps, or another person who has physical custody, and we refer to them as caretaker relatives. The dilemma that we face is when we have these types of cases, if there is welfare involved, cash assistance to the caretaker relative, under the law there's some direct assignment of rights and we can provide program services. However, for those people who do not take advantage of that system and just want child support services, we actually have to go through a series of legal processes in order to take care of an existing order, shut it down between the parents, and enter a new order for the caretaker relative. Bottom line is this causes a delay in getting child support to the person who has the children. Oftentimes, we're required to continue to send support to a parent that we know does not have the children, and in fact, may be telling us so. This would allow us to remedy this by doing a single action, a more expedited action, where in essence, we would join all the parties, the previous parties, mom and dad, and the new party, maybe that's Aunt Sally, all to one action and take care of everything in one single action. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there questions? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on the work session on House Bill 2234.
I move 2234 to the floor of the group presentation.
Thank you. Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2234 to the floor to pass. Discussion? Objection? We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2236.
Again, Ron L. Stankel, the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division. This particular bill is brought to you today requesting that we change the name of our particular division. The Support Enforcement Division has a new mission statement, which is to enhance the well-being of children and promote positive parental involvement by providing child support program services to families. In the past, we've been seen very much as an enforcement agency, someone there to collect money to reimburse the state. That has not always been our focus, even though it seemed to be so, and certainly is not our focus under the current mission statement. The Attorney General and the Director of the Child Support Program both agree that it would be more appropriate to have a name that does not only reflect our enforcement services, and so we still would ask that our name be changed to the Division of Child Support. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
This is your new friendlier image.
We are really reaching out to the non-custodial parents. We do provide services to the entire family, not just one side or the other. We think this is just another step in making that clear for you.
Yeah. Senator Duncan says it's just like the IRS.
I hope not. Fair point, Senator Duncan.
Question. Yeah, we'll close the public hearing.
Bill 2364 do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney.
You want to keep me on your first name.
I forget because you haven't started any bills recently. Move House Bill 2236 to the floor. The new pass recommendation. Discussion. Objection. The word.
I'm sharing it.
Senator Courtney, I'll carry it.
No, sir.
Well, now our public hearing on House Bill 2237.
For the record, we're now Stankel, Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division, here today in support of this bill on behalf of the state agencies in the child support program. House Bill 2237 was a bill that was worked on by our division as well as the Oregon Health Division's Parental Health and Vital Statistics Section, is often what we refer to it as. In essence, this bill talks to changing the law to make it clear that an administrative order establishing paternity has the same force and effect as a judicial order for purposes of creating a new birth record, both to put the legally established father's name on the record and possibly to put the child's new surname on the record when they create that new certificate. It's a technical amendment to make it clear in the law that that can occur. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Seeing none,
we'll move on. House Bill 2267A goes forward to pass. Senator Courtney's his name.
Senator Peter Courtney has moved to House Bill 2237.
The first name in history of names.
Really?
Yeah.
And why is that?
It went back a while.
It did?
I mean, it's been around a while.
Uh-huh.
It's short.
Uh-huh.
It means rock.
Yep.
It's rock. I'm sort of a rock.
Simon Peter, the rock?
Well, yeah. Actually, the Simon, they would name him Peter, but I think, I don't know which one, but it was rock. Yeah.
What do you use as that in your campaign?
Why not a rock?
You know, I never thought of that. I could use a rock.
Is that a full service rock?
I just never.
You can throw it. You can sit on it. I mean, there's all.
I never thought of that. I could have used a rock all these years. The rabbit did pretty good. You know, the rabbit did pretty good on me, even though you guys spent $300,000 to try to stop me.
Are we going to hear about that the rest of our lives?
Yeah, you are.
All right.
Have you ever seen a rabbit a long time?
No, I never did.
I don't have to show it to you.
Right, is that the Peter Rabbit? Is that the idea?
And it glows in the dark, too. There's a Peter, the rabbit actually glows in the dark, and the car lights.
Doesn't that violate some kind of...
It may have, but I did it.
What were we here for? And Senator Courtney moves it to the floor to pass. Is there other discussion? If not, motion carries. Who would like to carry 2237?
I'll take my carry.
Oh, I see. Good. Thank you. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 3051. And I need to sign up. I know Kevin Campbell has some people. So Dale Penn and
Jack Powell.
I'm not sure I'll hold it. We have special guests here today in the hearing room. We have Senator Duncan's wife, Donna, who we know from the dinner recently and other social engagements, and she's joined by two ladies in red blazers. And I think the courtesies were extended to them today, if I recall. But, so welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Pat Jensen and
Senator. So welcome, Pat Jensen. So this is the hardest working committee, and we also try to have the most fun.
They wouldn't know about the first part.
No. Mr. Penn and Ms. Powell, who would like to go first?
I will, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. I'm representing the District Attorney Association. This bill 3051 is a high priority bill from the Police Chief Association, the Sheriff's Association, Oregon State Police, and law enforcement. It basically was designed to deal with a problem that has occurred concerning implied consent hearings. When someone is arrested for driving under the influence, independent of the criminal action, there is the possibility of an administrative hearing on whether or not their license should be suspended based upon a breath sample of their blood. And so these hearings take place, and what has occurred over the years is, over the last 20 years, these hearings have become very elongated. They have gone beyond the scope of the original intent of just focusing on what was the probable cause for the stop, what was the process for the breathalyzer blow. There's been very little capability to continue a hearing if a police officer had problems concerning sickness or other things, difficulties. And this has resulted in a large number of complaints to law enforcement, and so that was the motivation for introducing 3051. This was heard on the House side. There was a work group that was set up on the House side. Representative Zansky was in charge of that work group. We had defense lawyers, my office, others involved in that. Not everyone came to agreement, but Representative Przanski basically made the decisions on what would go forward, and so you have the A. and Gross bill before you. You'll see that in Section 1, what it does is it expands and allows some ability for a continuance if the officer is ill or other conflicts. It allows one continuance for the officer. In the other sections, there's a statement of legislative policy on page 3 of the bill. This is subsection 4, subsection 5, where it says, this subsection shall be narrowly construed so as to affect the legislative purpose of limiting the scope of hearings under this section. And that was a training issue that we were told by Department of Motor Vehicles and hearings examiners that they would be able to use that to then again talk with their hearings examiners to remind them that the focus is to be on these statutory and case law procedures, not to allow it to go beyond. Now, Officer Powell could give you examples of that, but it's simply has gone way beyond and has been a discovery session rather than focusing on the issues. You are presented with two different sets of amendments, the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments, and they relate to Section 3 of the bill, which is on the last page. And this is probably the policy choice for you that is still in dispute. Ms. Swenson will testify and will argue that the Dash A2 amendment should be the appropriate method. There is a procedure in the bill itself, which is Section 3 on the last page, and this is the problem that what happens here is these tapes of these hearings are destroyed after 30 days. There is no prosecutor there. There's an officer subpoenaed, there is an administrative law judge, and there's a defense attorney and the defendant. And typically, the defense attorney can order a copy of the tape, but as I said, after 30 days, they're destroyed. It is not unusual in many DA's offices that we never even know of this hearing until months later. The tape is gone. What occurs is that a transcript may be developed, and then the officer is cross-examined based on the transcript, but they're never provided a copy. They're never given a copy of the tape or the transcript. Clearly, the discovery law mandates right now that the defense should provide a copy of that tape and transcript if they intend to use it. That is the Dash 2 amendments that the OCDLA would like to have inserted back into the bill. That doesn't change anything. That's the law right now. And in fact, there's case law where the Court of Appeals has said, typically, I've got to say from my experience, that the decision to call a witness is made a split second before that witness appears. I never received discovery ahead of time. And there was a case that Judge Domenez wrote on in Court of Appeals where they allowed a sanction for discovery because the defense lawyer said that the statement of the victim that they had received from their investigator, they didn't decide to use it until right when the cross-examination started. And Judge Domenez simply said, that is ludicrous. This intent here is that decision should be made ahead of time, and obviously the victim of the crime, you're going to use a prior statement. And that's what we're dealing with here. The arresting officer is definitely going to be the crucial witness in a driving under the influence case. The original bill says that they have up until 7 days before trial to make that decision. And then if they say, we're going to use this transcript, then they must provide a copy of the tape, or if they did transcribe it, a copy of the transcription so that the officer has an opportunity to see it before trial. We don't think that's oppressive. That was what the work group came up with as a way to allow the defense a lot of time to make that decision, but to allow the officer to receive a copy of that transcript before the trial. We did the Dash 3 amendments was an attempt after this bill has come over to the Senate to try to still deal with this issue raised by the Dash 2 amendments. We would propose that as an alternative if the committee believes that there needs to be some change, but it simply requires the same obligation as on the district attorney as there is on the defense attorney. We've never intended it to be any way different. The state always has an obligation to provide this information. If it isn't provided, it's going to be suppressed. But also to make it clear that there's no duty to transcribe the tape. It's not our intent. And so that's specifically in the Dash 3 amendments. If you'd like to adopt those, we certainly suggest those to you. We don't see that that harms anything. But our big issue is if you adopt the Dash 2 amendments, which says the tape and transcript doesn't need to be provided until the attorney intends to call the witness, we will have accomplished nothing with this bill. We believe the 7 days notice before trial is an excellent compromise. That was the compromise worked in the work group on the House side. And with that, that's the bill and the reasons for these changes. We do believe that this will help bring the scope of these hearings down in time. We'll cut down on overtime. Certainly will allow the defendant to explore the issues that are important on the administrative suspension, but also will provide the capability to get a continuance if it really is necessary for the officer and help a training component, both for officers and the hearings examiners, to help keep these hearings to a smaller amount of time. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's hear from Sergeant Howell first, since he has to leave, before we open up the questions.
Thank you, Chair Bryant. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Powell. I'm a police officer of the City of Portland. Kevin Gamble promoted me to sergeant today. Actually, I'm just a street trooper. And I have been for 24 years, and most of that time I've spent working in the traffic division, working with DUI drivers. I submitted a copy of my written testimony, and I think that the A and gross version of House Bill 3051 starts to plug up some of the leaks. I don't think it's perfectly the way law enforcement would like it, but I think it's a nice compromise. I think that the engrossed bill allows the flexibility in the hearings process that was probably originally intended, but through the process has grown into something very different. And this is a matter to me of just leveling the playing field a little bit instead of making it all one-sided. I don't think it will disadvantage. It will not disadvantage the petitioner at all, in my opinion. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Could you summarize for the committee or give some examples of what the problem is now with the existing law as far as the hearings and the fact that they turn into a discovery proceeding rather than concentrating on whether or not that license should be suspended?
Sure, Brian, thank you. The rules of evidence in these hearings are extremely broad. Hearsay and well, for lack of a better term, double hearsay is allowed. Anything goes, any question that can be even vaguely related to the incident. I've been in hearings where officers have been asked about their personal life, situation with other officers that were there at the scene for cover. I've also been in a hearing where I was personally asked about my own drinking habits as part of the discovery for whatever reason.
And here's the officer allowed those questions?
Yes, they have. So it can get pretty far afield, as well as without any defense. There's no the district attorney does not attend these hearings, and so the officer is left there at her own defense. You have the lawyer for the defense and the judge, who is supposed to be impartial, but the officer does not have a lot of flexibility in dealing with that.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, we did talk with Department of Motor Vehicles and Department of Transportation about this whole issue, and they believe that some training would be helpful with administrative law judges, and that's where we came up with the idea that in the work group that maybe that statement of legislative purpose would be helpful. There is other testimonies at the House or other witnesses. The governor's counsel on drunk driving supported these changes and had dealt with similar complaints. And also, people involved in the original bill that set up the implied consent program to testify about that these were to be very narrow in scope. And so I think those were important points that were made on the House side.
Questions for these witnesses? Yes,
just a question, Dale. On your dash 3 amendments, as I read it, it requires that the cost of the page of the transcript be borne by the party who receives the copy. Doesn't generally speaking for a deposition or a court transcript, doesn't the requester end up bearing the burden of the cost?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, we were making very clear in lines 9 through 11 that it isn't required that you transcribe this tape.
Right.
You're going to receive a tape. And some people may just order the tape. It's $5. Then your only obligation is to give a copy of the tape if you're going to use, you know, that tape in cross-examination. However, if you go forward, and many lawyers do this, and have a transcript made, then if you have a transcript, then you need to provide a copy of that transcript. That's what it says.
So, Rob.
I think what I was asking is that 9, 7, and 8 ask that the party who's the recipient of the copy has to pay for that. And I'm assuming you're talking, but I'll put some examples on. The district attorney asks for the tape to be transcribed. Mm-hmm. And as I read this, this would require the defense attorney to pay for the copy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, no, this simply says that if I ordered a copy of the transcript, then I need to provide a copy, and I can, the cost of copying that can be charged. It's basically discovery as it is now.
Okay.
The few times that I receive discovery, generally I will be charged by the defense attorney, 25 cents a page or whatever it is, and so we will pay that amount.
Okay.
Yes.
Mr. Chair. Be assured that the state is making sure they are charging for every single copy of discovery they provide to the defense.
Ms. Chair and Senator Brown, yes, we charge $5 for a felony case and $3.50 for a misdemeanor case, so we do collect that.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the matter of allowing one postponement for officer reasons, what happens now if an officer simply cannot make it to a hearing?
Ms. Chair and Senator Burdick, then what happens is the officer doesn't appear, the suspension is not ordered, and that's the end of it. And that's why we believe there needs to be some flexibility to allow for one continuance, just one.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you for the testimony.
Thank you.
Ingram.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Ingrid Brunson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. A couple of preliminary comments. So one is that in these hearings, basically, it's the due process clause of the federal constitution and the comparable provisions of Oregon law, which mandate that you can't take away something as valuable to a citizen as a license without having an appropriate hearing. So that's the reason we have these hearings. And the license is being removed before a conviction for drunk driving. So this process obviously has to take place before and independent of the criminal prosecution. So that's what sets out the limits of relevance and so forth that apply at these hearings. Now, statutorily and by rules of evidence and so forth, we can talk about certain parameters for that testimony, but it basically is the limitations of due process. If, in fact, somebody is asking about an officer and his use of alcohol, either that is directly relevant because it has to do with some allegation in connection with the arrest, or it's completely irrelevant. But that's a judicial ruling. The hearings officer needs to make a good ruling. We're not objecting to the inclusion of the language on page 3 of the A. Engrossed bill. It may serve a purpose. My members report to me that they do not find that hearings officers need training. They find them to be expert and well-trained, but if the committee feels that this somehow calls their attention to what the legislature feels the scope of these hearings should be, that's fine. Our principal concern with the bill at this point has to do with the proposed A2 amendments, which were submitted at our request. And indeed, they do track current law. So once again, the purpose of placing them here would be simply to call attention to the fact that in the context of these proceedings, there is a duty to disclose information that you intend to use in the trial of the case. In the same way that we're calling to the hearings officer's attention the need to mind the scope of this hearing, using the A2 amendments would call to the attention of the defense lawyer the fact that the same obligation would apply in this context as applies generally in the criminal law, and that requires the disclosure of this information as soon as it's determined that it's going to be used. That is not an easy matter to determine. And let me give you an example. If you as an attorney for a person accused of driving under the influence had attended a suspension hearing and represented your client at that hearing and heard testimony at that hearing, and you then proceed to a trial on the merits of the driving under the influence charge and say the officer indeed is there, the same officer who testified at the license hearing, and he testifies, or she, in such a way that you find that testimony at trial is more favorable to your client than what might have been said at this earlier hearing. you certainly will not use in any way that earlier testimony. It's not in your interest to do so. And so there are clearly occasions when that piece is simply not going to be used. And both sides in a criminal case at this point have the same obligation, which is to provide only that information which you intend to use, and you have to provide it as soon as you intend to use it. I think it's unprecedented, frankly, to tell a lawyer that if you have a particular document in your file that you got properly and legally for your consideration in preparing a legal case, you must turn that over to the other side regardless of its relevance. It may not, in fact, be something you ever intend to use or ever, in fact, use. It would be like saying to the prosecutor, if you happen to have in your file a statement about some matter, you must give it to the defense, whether or not it's relevant to the guilt or innocence of the defendant, whether or not it's relevant to anything. Now, I hear that there are concerns about the fact that prosecutors don't learn of the existence of this paper transcript until 30 days has passed, and I understand from the testimony that the tape can be destroyed in that time. I think there are other solutions for prosecutors than putting the burden on the defense lawyer to provide them with information, one of which would be, in every DUI prosecution, to simply call the DMV or look at the DMV record and see if a hearing is scheduled. And if one is, order a tape directly. Prosecutors can do that. That's exactly what defense lawyers have to do. The DMV could be required to keep them more than 30 days. If they're relevant for 90 days or 180 days, I can't imagine that the burden is so tremendous that they couldn't keep those a little longer than they do. I think this is not the appropriate solution. I think it's a fairly unusual approach, frankly, to require one lawyer to go through their file and provide to the other side something that may be damaging. In fact, you might make a choice that you dare not get this document for fear that it's damaging to your client, and you have handed over to the prosecution something that's harmful. So then you're preventing the lawyer from doing their job, which is to investigate, examine all this information, and make an intelligent decision about what your case is going to look like, depending upon all the information that's available to you. It's simply unfair to ask that lawyer to pull out of that file and give something to the state which may or may not be required to be disclosed under discovery.
Ingrid, what if you didn't have to provide that information if you decided you weren't going to use it?
Mr. Chair, I think that would resolve the problem, but you may not decide that until you've heard the testimony of the witness. And that's the problem that I hear them concerned about, is that at the last minute, and quite frankly, I think their concern is really this. They aren't aware and they don't prepare their witness properly without having that information. So the witness testifies contrary to what the witness testified at the earlier hearing, is successfully impeached. That's their real concern. And in order to resolve that, they want that document before their witness is called to the stand so that they can review that statement that they made earlier. I think that's what it
is. I'm sure you're correct. But in most cases, doesn't the defense attorney know 7 days in advance that they may use the transcript or the testimony from the prior hearing?
Mr. Chair, I would say in many cases they know. In some cases they do not. And as I said, even if they have a good reason to believe that they may use this, when it comes to the trial, they may find that the testimony of the officer is significantly less harmful in the trial than it was at the hearing, in which case there will be no cross-examination based on that hearing. There will be no discussion of that testimony. So that's why the decision can't necessarily be made up front, in my opinion.
Okay.
Sure.
Yes, I'm trying
to. Ingrid, help me out a little bit. A person who testifies in a prior hearing, does he have the right to refresh your memory us to that prior testimony?
Mr. Chair and Senator Eterno, they always can ask to refresh their memory from any source, from any documents that they know about. And if the officer knows that he or she has testified at such a proceeding, I think they could inform the prosecutor, listen, there was a hearing in this case, and would you get that information so that I can have it before I testify in this case?
But, Mr. Chair, it's been a while since I testified in court, so bear with me for a moment. But it's my impression that the officer also has the right to review that transcript prior to testimony to see what he testified to in a prior occasion, perhaps in on the hearing or a prelim.
Mr. Chair and Senator Turner, he or she has an avenue the right to review it, but nobody in particular has to provide it to him or her. I mean, they can request their own or obtain it from the state or whatever.
You would not have an objection. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I know you wouldn't let me do that. But you wouldn't have an objection to before cross-examination allowing the witness to review the prior testimony if, in fact, the DA was intending to use that transcript.
If the defense was intending to use the transcript, Mr. Chair. So the question is...
So the trial began, the officer testified... Before you begin your cross-examination.
In fact, Mr. Chair, if you don't turn it over then, you better not be using it, because you have certainly formed the opinion that you're going to use it, and you absolutely have to turn it over, in my opinion.
Yes.
I just leaned over to the good chair and asked whether HCR 87 if passed would allow the victim to testify and participate in one of these hearings. I assume it would. Require notice to the victim?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, this would be an administrative hearing, so very likely it's not included in a criminal prosecution. I don't believe it would be considered to be part of the criminal prosecution, but if we're in the courtroom and say there's a pretrial hearing on these matters, yes, then under HCR 87 the victim could say, I want to be heard, I believe.
Other questions? Thank you for testimony. That concludes the public hearing on this. I want to go through the other public testimony before we go into work session on some other bills, and also representing Morrissey. I maybe want to check find another bill that may have been useful too, so I want to give you that opportunity. So let me, for a moment, first thing on our agenda today deals with Senate Bill 875, and this is a bill that I'd like to send to rules, but I think it's the wrong bill. Pardon? Well, and so,
you want to send this to
no,
rules?
No.
I don't want to send anything to rules.
It's headed to the wrong committee. I think I gave staff the wrong number, because the bill that was requested is one from Senator Shannon, dealing with allowing forest rangers to carry firearms, and I haven't given that a hearing, and she had requested that go to general government. So, but that's not this particular bill. I think that's another number.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think we should move 875 to form to do past recommendations.
Public hearing with anybody who's serving in the legislative assembly. No, it's fuck you.
I don't want the sheriff over here to move.
Well, it's not up. But anyway, what I'm saying is I think the notice is wrong. So this is not the bill that I intended to move, so I'll have to come back later and think about this. The reason I hadn't scheduled this particular bill is I didn't think it accomplished anything that isn't already accomplished. Senator Carno.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it clarifies a gray area for retired law enforcement officers.
Did I
do? And maybe there's some folks in the audience that have to play in the future. I'd like to be on myself, and it should be a strong bunch of audience.
Okay. Well, we can't do it today because we haven't had a public hearing on it yet, and that wasn't the purpose of what it was posted for. But when I look at subparagraph A, the part you're deleting says whether active or honorably retired, and then you're saying whether active or honorably retired.
Active, you can still have the right to put you back.
I think you can now. I don't think the bill has anything. Am I wrong?
That's the kind of bill we passed.
All right. Well, we'll continue that discussion later. We'll now open a public hearing on Health Bill 2221 and extend on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Benjamin DeHaan. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I am here today in support of House Bill 2221, the AIM Growth version. Very quickly, what the bill does is it makes it clear that those people seeking to visit inmates who are incarcerated in the state's institutions are not eligible for contested case hearings if they're denied access to the inmate for good cause. As many of you may know, the department has promulgated administrative rules which lay out procedures whereby the public can visit inmates, and it's some of the reasons we deny access for the security and safety of the institution. That would include denying access to people who are helping to plan escapes, who smuggle contraband, and or who in any other way represent a risk to the safety of the institution. Recently, a few inmates have filed suit against the state, arguing that they're entitled to a full contested case hearing. And even though they haven't ruled on this yet, the Department of Justice has suggested to us that we should clarify the statute which covers this. If formal case hearings became the standard mode of operation, it would be expensive. Our folks have indicated to us it will cost about $600,000 a biennium. And this bill was amended in the House. Representative Bowman had some additions which are included in there, which sets up another level of review, an internal review for those people, an informal internal review for those people who have been denied access to inmates who are incarcerated. So very briefly, that's the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Walt? Okay. There are no other witnesses. We close the public hearing. Go on a work session on 2-2.
Mr. Chair?
One.
Don't we have to move this away from these, or has it been there already?
No, that's
the wrong bill.
Sorry.
You got the wrong bill. I made the same mistake. I thought I was already moved away from these.
You made the same mistake as I did?
Right.
I move House Bill 2221 to the floor with a brief recommendation.
And then Duncan.
Duncan's on the board.
Move House Bill 2221 and Gross floor with a brief recommendation. Any objections? Hearing none? Done. What do we do now?
Well, Chair, yes. Can I vote on House Bill 225, 2234, 2236, and 2237? I vote aye. It does not change the outcome, and I assume that no one has any objections.
Well, I don't know if they do or not, because you just assumed it, but did you get all that, please? Whatever she did.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like permission to vote aye on the same thing.
Well, yeah, anybody always want to vote on something? 6 o'clock aye, we can all get voted in there. Anybody else feel like everyone? Okay. Do you have all the ayes that voted because they weren't here now voting? Do you have that all, please? Thank you so much. I do, and I'll think about it. Okay, let me see. What's that? The carrier of the last bill, House Bill 2221 Angros, will be Senator Vern the Duncan. Is that okay to ask? Can you
fine.
You want to do that?
It's pretty heavy load. Because I want to carry something in your head without a real impact.
What you feel like you're in that? Okay.
I think we'll make a move.
House Bill, open public hearing, and possible work session. House Bill 2350A Gross. John Bradley, Multnomah County DA's office. This guy's been around since BC.
Okay.
They did. I think I'm going to be here in first back in 81.
I did. Sir Courtney. John Bradley with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office.
Can I ask you a question? How come you never, we don't see you in the victim's rights issues? We see somebody else in your office. There's a fixture. How come we don't see you? Who's that? I wonder why that is. I just need to know that emotionally.
I like to take the more non-controversial.
I see. I was hoping you'd say something else. Okay. We don't ever see your boss in victim's rights issues. Is there another? Could you help me on that one too, please?
But you get letters from him, I think.
Oh, we do? Okay. Anyway, I don't mean to embarrass you. I just had this urge, this hankering to know that. So thank you for being upfront with me. Thank you very much. Now proceed to tell me about this bill.
Chair Courtney, this is a bill that is actually on the title of the bill. It says removes restrictions of limits of probation for possession of controlled substance to first-time offenders. That's inaccurate. What it does is it amends ORF 475.245. And what that law has done, it's been on the book, I believe, since the mid-70s, is it allows for diversion if somebody, in a drug case, or a person does not have a prior drug offense. And what we've done in Multnomah County is we have a program called STOP. And what we want to do is we may want to use this to get people into STOP. But the problem is that when people come into STOP, I don't know, is everybody here familiar with the program?
They're called Summer's Drop. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I don't, and then why don't you just tell us quickly, because we're fighting with who's carrying the bill already.
All right. What the STOP program is this was something that we did in Multnomah County starting about 4 or 5 years ago, where we took people who had drug problems and were charged with possession of small amounts of drugs. And diverted them into the STOP program. And it's an acupuncture program. It's a one-year program where somebody's got to go through. It's quite frankly, it's more intensive than normal probation. But one of the things you get in here is you get people who have long histories. You have people who have prior drug offenses. And so what we do is we make it available to a wide variety of people to get into this program. And the program actually has been pretty successful. In my 28 years in law enforcement in the Metropolitan Office, I'll say this, it's probably about the best program we've had. But what we need to do is, we have taken this section, we've deleted the prior and said that one of the avenues in the stop could be this deferred sentencing where a person would come in and either plead guilty or be found guilty, be put on probation, put into the STOP program, and if they successfully complete it, they don't have a record. And that's what we've been doing in a sense for 5 years anyway. We've oftentimes had people come in, stipulate to the facts, no finding or adjudication of guilty at that time. If they later fail the program, they're then found guilty and given probation. We're just, we're just putting this at the front end. This was drafted at the request of Mr. Schrunk. I've talked to Doug Bray, who's the Multnomah County Court Coordinator. He said that they are heavily in favor of this bill, as is Judge Ellis. And also, when I testified in the House, I had been in contact with Mr. Hennings, and he indicated at that time, and I assume he still does, is that he has no opposition to this bill. Now, that's not to say he supports it, you know, wholeheartedly. I'm just saying he's indicated he had no opposition to it. It's sort of a... we're just trying to take a bill to make a vehicle for us. And also it provides throughout the state the possibility of putting people in these diversion programs who do have prior drug offenses.
Questions? Mr. Bradley? Comments? Okay. Thanks so much for your testimony. This is it, right? I said we're already in work session. Yes, Senator Brown. Senator Brown moves House Bill 2350 and goes for due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? So done.
Mr. Chair.
The Learned High Counsel John Horton will carry the bill.
This is a Multnomah County program that they are assisting. Jimmy or I should be able to carry the bill.
Yeah, but he's going to go work for Multnomah County VA after he's through here.
I knew I shouldn't have
questioned. Can I ask you, Senator Burke, are you going to be mad if she carries it?
Yes.
Okay. Are you going to be mad if she carries it?
Of course.
I mean, you work it out. Okay, get it on Phil. I got enough.
All right.
It's
skinny.
It's
fine.
Watch this. All right. What happened? Are you all right or what? Have you been in and out 5,000 times? Are we supposed to get him up here? What's going on?
We're 37, I think.
You want to do that now or just do this quickly?
Do it now if he's not on the
call. Alright, come up here. Sit here, please. Because if you come in and out of here one more time.
Forget what a call of the house is like. You guys don't have them.
We don't. Alright. Now, you're here for what?
House Bill 3047.
Open a public hearing on 3047. Please proceed. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an amendment to Representative Mannix's bill, and my amendment is a -A2. And what it does is, it encourages school districts to form a safe school alliance and so on. And this bill has been amended. My original idea has been amended several times because of objection with the vagueness or specificity of the language, a little of both. I did visit the Ben Lapine School District and talked with Superintendent Munchie about a program that they have there, and interestingly, Senator Bryant had a bill that reflected part of the Safe School Alliance. It's my intent with this encouragement to spend some time during the interim talking with, as I say on this cover page, the Superintendent of Public Education to conduct a survey and publish and distribute a compilation of best safe school practices throughout the United States to school districts in Oregon. Now, my preliminary conversations, they did express an interest in doing this. That would be one intent of encouraging this kind of thing to happen. I would follow through with not only the State Department of Education, but at the county level, school districts are encouraged to work within the Public Safety Coordinating Council. Now, every county in the state has such a council. Wayne County, it's been a very effective council. Our school superintendent from District 19 sits on that body. There's a lot of discussion going on, as there must be, to coordinate safety efforts between the community and the school district. I would also like to encourage the school districts in their own area to look within the district to examine what their particular school needs in terms of the physical facilities to set up a safety zone, to conduct in-service training with the police and the fire and the medics. All of this with the idea that roadblocks and barriers can be identified, so we may come back in the next legislation to take care of some of the inhibitions, the prohibitions to implementing the Safe School Alliance. The legislature can't solve the problem, but what the legislature can do, as I just mentioned, is to identify some of the roadblocks and barriers that exist. And most importantly, I've learned during my first session that you have to come in with basically some agreement from the partners affected by the legislation. There has to be some agreement coming into the legislature in order for these things to really get a fair hearing and pass. So the amendment that I have is rather innocuous. It simply calls for an encouragement, but the encouragement, I feel, would open the door for some real discussion. And so I would urge that this be incorporated into Representative Mannix's bill. Now, in my conversation with him, he's perfectly happy to. In fact, he thinks this is a great piece of legislation and is happy to have it included into his bill. So with that, I would be very happy to answer questions.
Questions for Representative Morissette.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tarno.
Bill, I sent a letter to you from Scott Munchie,
yes,
in Ben Lapine School District about a software program
mm-hmm.
that deal with behavior tracking. Have you had a chance to take a look at that software program you're talking about? Promoters,
well, the software program exists in 50 school districts, and I've asked various superintendents if they're aware of it. Some of them are, and some of them are not. It can be used for a variety of purposes, but it does lend itself to, for instance, when there is an infraction, that can be noted on the software. It can be verified. At some point, when records have to be pulled up, they can see over a period of time the incidents that have taken place, the reports that have been made about the student, and it makes it much easier to keep track of what's going on. So when information is exchanged between the juvenile justice field and the school district, there is a much more complete record. Now, the software is not specifically geared toward this, but it allows this to happen. The software can be used for many things.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you call him, Bill?
I'm sorry.
You sort of took liberty to.
I did. He's a freshman.
Well, I
thought I could do that. I tied myself after you, because you did the same thing to me after the freshman.
Well,
I haven't forgotten that.
Well,
I'm getting material for the Follies tonight, so just keep it up.
Did he give you permission to take those records?
No, but you didn't either when I first came here.
Well,
I was in judiciary when I was a freshman when you did that to me. I have not forgotten that.
Okay. All right. Then, it's okay. Okay. Well, were you offended by him taking liberties with you?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Did anybody else wish to speak to Representative Morissette from Springfield? Thank you very much for coming. Can I ask you a question? Was it a pleasant experience?
Yes, it really was.
Because,
I like the background.
I'd like to say the same thing when I go to the House committees, and it's not real pleasant over there. So I just wanted to tell you that. I just want to be very frank with you about that. But it wasn't just sort of convivial and hospitable and things like that?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
very dignified. I noticed that right
away. Full service. It's a full service committee.
Are you going somewhere? With this bylaw.
Well,
he's got things to do. He's going to be a call of the House.
Are you on a call right now?
No. I'm preparing for my freshman folly act. I'm writing down material.
Yeah.
I've got some great ideas from being here.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
No one else has signed up or at this time, so right? Am I right?
That is correct.
We close the public hearing on 3047. We go to Cassie Osborne. Come forward, please. We open the public hearing on House Bill 3047, Andy Gross. And 2396 angle. See, that's a new, see what I just did there? I opened a public hearing on two bills at once. That you learn these things. See that, Senator Duncan? You see what I did there?
I really wasn't paying attention.
It is something to that. I don't care which one you start on, but if you start on one, you got to finish on the other. So, and you're the only one signed up, and you're neutral on one, and you hate the other one. So whatever you want to do.
I see the chair more than Bunny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for recommending this Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. On House Bill 3047, since this will be easy, that's a product of a work group which met, again, prior to this committee meeting, realized that we need another amendment to accomplish what we really want to do. So we asked the Chair Bryant if he could place this back for a hearing next week, and he agreed so that we can get that amendment and finish the work that we actually need to do.
Okay.
Regarding House Bill 2396, this deals with the waiver of use to adult court, and it's the judicial waiver as opposed to the automatic waiver that's done by Measure 11. In a judicial waiver, there's a hearing in which the judge looks at the good side of the child and the bad side of the child, and I'll leave you to define which is which, and then makes a decision about whether this youth should be tried as an adult for the act that they committed, which would be a crime if they committed an adult. And there's a list of crimes which the court can only waive, and this would add Class C felonies when the youth used or threatened to use of a firearm. Prior to Measure 11, this waiver process was used quite a lot, and it was the only way in order to get youth that were charged with serious offenses into adult court when facing adult sentences. Since Measure 11 came into effect, actually, the last statistics that I looked at, youth over 15 years old, there's only been two in the state of Oregon that have gone through the waiver process. of this judicial waiver hearing. There are a large number of waived youth in Oregon right now. In fact, the largest number we've ever had, because what happens is when a youth is charged with a Measure 11 crime, if that youth is either convicted of a lesser offense, which is a non-Measure 11 crime, or pleads to a non-Measure 11 crime, they then have either the opportunity to go through a waiver hearing on the adult side to decide whether they should be sent back to juvenile court, or they have, if it's part of a plea, usually what happens is the district attorney requires as part of that plea that the youth waives to juvenile jurisdiction and agrees to be sentenced as an adult. So I see that the number of youth that would really be affected by this will be youth that were charged originally with Measure 11s and are pleading to a lesser non-Measure 11 offense. And it would add, essentially, more crimes that they could be not sent back to juvenile court. In other words, right now, if the youth is charged with a Measure 11 offense, goes to trial and is found guilty of one of these Class C felonies, which requires use or threatened use of a firearm, what would happen, since it's a non-waivable charge, that youth would have to go back to juvenile court and be sentenced as a juvenile. So that's the practical effect of adding this. However, what the real problem is, and this is a problem that I have to note that I did not even notice over in the House, is the language that is added in Section 2. In Section 2, they add ORS 161.610 as a mandatory minimum sentence which shall be imposed if the youth is waived as an adult. Right now, if the youth is waived from juvenile court into adult court, a mandatory minimum sentence cannot be imposed except in the case of aggravated murder. This would add the firearm mandatory minimum sentence. The problem that we have in adding that is I think you have a proportionality problem, which I have to admit, again, I didn't notice. Proportionality problem, it means that you can't be sentencing one crime which has a higher level, which is considered a higher level crime, worse than a crime that's at the lower level, or less than a crime that's at the lower level. So these Class C felonies which have a firearm, the mandatory minimum sentence, according to this, which shall be imposed, is a mandatory minimum sentence of at least 5 years. It goes 5, 10, 20, based on the number of convictions. For an arson in the first degree, which would then be drawn down from an attempted arson in the first degree, if that youth has no prior adult history, their presumptive sentence under the sentencing guidelines is 16 to 18 months. That is a Class B felony, which is getting 16 to 18 months, as opposed to a Class C felony, which under this structure could get up to 5 years, a mandatory sentence of 5 years. So I think you have a proportionality problem by adding the 161.610 into the Section 2 of this bill. So that's my major problem with this bill. Again, I have to say that I didn't notice it over in the House, but I think it's a serious enough problem that it's something that we need to look at. I think you can solve that problem, obviously, by taking that site out and just leaving the mandatory minimum sentence for aggravated murder. It still gives the court the ability to give a serious sentence on those Class C felonies. They just can't give the mandatory minimum sentence to a juvenile.
Is this the one you spoke to me then before the hearing?
No, this is another one. I was actually awake this afternoon, which is probably a bad thing because I found the safe in two bills, but I didn't think he had mistaken.
Okay. So what you're asking for then is, both on this bill and the other one, the opportunity to go draft some amendments?
On House Bill 2396, I think you need to take out the 161.610, otherwise you have a proportionality problem.
If we take that out, which we can do, I think conceptually here, not Senate, and work it today, would that resolve your concern?
I guess I need to be clear on that. That would resolve the proportionality problem. Our concerns, my office always has concerns when we're trying to take away juvenile court jurisdiction from more and more youth. And this would be another way that youth could be moved from juvenile court jurisdiction into adult court jurisdiction.
Ms. Chen, would you like to address the proportionality issue?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I forgot to sign up for this bill. So if you've heard the opposition to the bill, I wanted to explain the reason for the bill. My name is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney, representing the District Attorney Association. There is no intent for this to be a device for ballot measure 11 or anything along those lines. The reason for this bill is the increase in gang violence in the state of Oregon. We have situations now where you have gang shootings, drive-by shootings that occurred. If no one, by the grace of God, is hit by the bullets, the crime that you have is unlawful use of a firearm, which this legislature passed a number of years ago to try to get a felony crime for drive-by shooting. Whether you're shooting a house, you're shooting other vehicles, you're shooting towards residences, that type of thing. And so that's the crime. Unfortunately, that is not a waivable offense. And so we have the situation, we've had it occur in our county and other counties, where you have someone who's extensively involved in gang activity, has been involved with a significant prior juvenile record, but they cannot be waived to adult court. This particular crime, they are not going to be a public safety bed in OIA, so there really are no options for this person. And whether it's 16, 17, as long as they aren't 18, the juvenile system is unable to deal with their repeated drive-by shootings. This bill simply authorizes the courts to do a remand hearing for that person, and if they look at prior record and what has already been done before, the background of the case, all of these issues, and they believe the juvenile system is no longer able to deal with this person, we believe they should be treated as an adult. It authorizes the judge to make that decision. It's not an automatic remand. It's through judicial process. Now, the proportionality issue, I do not believe that is a problem at all. In fact, in adult sentencing, all of those arguments, that's what the law is today. In any crime where there's a firearm, if we have a person who's 18 years old, they're going to be charged as an adult. There's the potential for a mandatory minimum under the firearm language. And yes, they can receive more sentence than some of these other crimes under guidelines. But that is a decision that has been made with the aggravating factor of a firearm. The one thing I would say is this firearm minimum, it does receive good time. So even though it's a 60-month sentence, it automatically is cut to 48 months. Secondly, on the first offense, the court is given discretion on whether to impose it at all. And so that's in the statute, and the judge can say, I don't want to give 48 months or 60 months, I want to give less, or I even want to give probation. But that only applies to the first offense. So that is not a proportionality issue. We have had this statute on the books for years. Certainly with guidelines, that's why it's very difficult to explain to anyone what is the maximum sentence. That whole argument about guidelines changes A, B, and C felonies, and you can receive a higher sentence for a lower category of crime when you look at the guidelines kind of analysis. But that is not a proportionality issue that makes this firearm minimum fatally flawed.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Kathy Osmond for Human Rights Project, the problem is that this language takes away the judge's discretion in that first time. What this says is that the mandatory minimum sentence under ORS 161.610 shall be imposed. Because they're adding it into language where they were saying that the mandatory minimum for the aggravated murder shall be imposed. And that's where you come up with a problem, is it takes away the judge's discretion for that first time because of the shall.
Mr. Chair, the intent is not to mandate that there be a prison sentence here, and we have no problem with changing that to a may if that would deal with it.
Page 15 on page 2.
Yes. The intent is that if you have someone with a significant prior record to the point where the judge is saying this person should be handled in the adult system, that all of the sentencing ramifications should be available to the adult court. That's the intent. And if they feel like something less or even a probation sentence is appropriate in the adult court, that's fine. But we believe that that should be available.
would, by changing that word to may, in your opinion, would that then take away the proportionality?
It certainly, I think, lessens the likelihood that there would be a successful proportionality challenge to it.
Would you agree, Mr. Mayor?
I believe that is the correct word to that one.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We'll close then the public hearing. No one else, I believe, wants to testify on this. And the chair would will open a work session. The chair would move on line 15, page 2, to change the word shall to may. And do that conceptually. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. The chair then would move House Bill 2396, Ian Grove, as amended to the floor to pass. Discussion? Objection? Sorry. I guess I haven't carried one today, have I? I will carry. Okay, I think it's scheduled for tomorrow, so we can do it here. I got to take it to both days. Okay. Thank you. Committee on 2807 will do that tomorrow. The proponent, Leslie Lewis, won't be available till then. So these are scheduled for tomorrow, too, so you have that option.
Okay.
We'll now open the public hearing on House Bill 2462 and invite Steve Zingel and Judy Brandon. Really? Many, many years ago, Mr. Chairman. Was that Eugene High School? Or?
He was statewide advisor committee to the senator when he was the superintendent for high school.
And how did that go?
Well, from my perspective, he asked the senator what he thought of me. I don't know.
It was a great experience. I had about 50 kids on them. I think on that same one from then, but I didn't think where else.
Katie Worrell?
Yes, Katie Worrell was on
the line.
What high school did you think of?
I went to Sheldon High School, graduated in 1987.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
When did you graduate from high school?
I'd rather not say. Chairman Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dingell. I'm here from the Marion County District Attorney's Office on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. And I don't know how much information you want on this bill. 2462, this was proposed to correct a Court of Appeals decision. And in essence, what happened is you had a victim, a corporation that had signed a civil penalty, not having any idea that they were foreclosing criminal prosecution, just simply exercising their right to collect money as part of the civil penalty, and the court interpreted that as a civil compromise barring criminal prosecution. That is very different from the typical civil, from the required civil compromise process, which requires that the victim sign a knowing acknowledgement that says by accepting this money, they understand that there will be no criminal prosecution, that this is the end of the matter. And so that's what this bill does.
Now, I've probably done a dozen civil compromise. And correct me if I'm wrong, but normally what happens is business comes in, it's some embezzlement or something, and criminal charges are made. And then through negotiations, usually with the defendant's attorney, they say, okay, we can pay back the $10,000. And if we do that, then would you agree to a civil compromise? Normally the business says yes, because I'm interested in getting the money back.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's no guarantee that the prosecution will continue.
No, that's not correct. If there is a formal civil compromise under the civil compromise statute, part of the paperwork that the victim signs is, there's basically a couple parts to it. One, I acknowledge that the money that I receive is full satisfaction for the harm that's been done to me, and two, I understand that by signing this document, there will be no criminal prosecution. The victim knows that when they sign the acknowledgement.
But isn't it still up to the judge as to whether or not to accept it? Because I had one situation where the judge said, nope, I'm not going to agree to it. You think this is a bad enough situation that there should be a criminal prosecution.
That's right. It's up to the judge to accept it. The important thing about this bill and what this decision did is that the victim, in that case, the business, by simply, before the criminal prosecution ever got rolling, the person walked in and paid their, they sent them a letter that said you shoplifted, you know, the civil penalty is this. They came in and paid the civil penalty. They did not know at the time that they did it that they were foreclosing criminal prosecution, which is different than the civil compromise situation where the victim, when they sign the acknowledgement, they acknowledge that by taking this, they understand there won't be a criminal prosecution. That's all this does. That's the business, when they signed that paperwork and accepted the civil penalty, thought they were just taking the statutory civil penalty. They did not understand that the person wasn't going to be prosecuted. And there's no requirement in that civil damage thing that the victim understand that or that that be part of the paperwork.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. I won't add much to the testimony. I have written testimony before you. This bill comes to you because of a shoplifting case involving a large retailer in the state. And as explained, the retailer has an opportunity to ask for a civil penalty when a shoplifting case occurs. And that the damages can be paid up to 3 times the value of the item stolen, or up to $750. And this has been on the in the books of the statute for a while. What has happened, though, is this case was taken to the Supreme Court, and what was decided was that unless the legislature clarifies, this is at right now determined to be a civil compromise. So we're before you asking to clarify that civil penalty for a retailer to get reimbursed for the theft of a product is not a civil compromise.
And this doesn't change the civil compromise statute.
The as far as for other crimes?
The situation that I just described where you have to sign the two documents and get in court.
No. The statute is the same for those crimes. I mean, the victim in the retailer could sign a civil compromise document that says that acknowledging that we've received this $150 or whatever civil penalty and that we're satisfied with that and we don't want the person prosecuted. They can still do that process. I think the really important thing is that this changed what there were actually, I believe, 2 Court of Appeals decisions that had said before that this was not a civil compromise, that when the retailer took the civil penalty, it was not a civil compromise, and this decision caught everybody by surprise. So, you know, in that sense, it doesn't change it. There was one amendment in the House that did change the general civil compromise statute.
And was the Court of Appeals decision, was there a writ of review to the Supreme Court?
No, this was a, I think this was a Supreme Court decision.
This was
so,
the Supreme?
But there were 2, I think there were at least 2 and maybe 3 Court of Appeals decisions that go back 10 years, 7 years, 3 years that said that when a retailer took a civil remedy under that Chapter 30 section, that it was not a civil compromise.
The court cite PG versus Gold? We've got to change.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, I guess.
No.
I don't have to read the opinion in front of me.
I'm just curious, how many of us will pay the bundle to take this case to the Supreme Court? I just think it's very interesting that, assuming that the case was evolving, that the attorney's fees must have been substantial to take it that far.
And I think the penalty was only, I think the penalty paid was only $150.
It was a small item shoplifted. It was the principal. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Martin, you want to enlighten us on this today?
I can certainly help, Mr. Chairman. I think that Mr. Dingell and Ms. Brandis has done a good job, but certainly, members, when this bill came before the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law, it was one of the more confusing bills I've seen. Yeah, I guess something that I would emphasize is that this really does deal with two statutes. One is the civil compromise statute, which despite saying it's a criminal statute, not a civil statute. And the other one is the civil action statute. And regardless what people may think about the policy, because certainly that is open to debate, what this bill in part seeks to do, as I understand it from the proponent's perspective, is to clarify that simply if the civil action, I think $750 is paid, that does not by itself mean that the court is required to dismiss the case. If the defendant and the victim want to pursue the civil compromise, a separate option to have that case dismissed, that can still occur. But what happens with these two statutes in the state of Wisconsin seem to get a little bit confused. Now, another part of the bill that some of this may or may not speak to is that under current law, the state can certainly object to the civil compromise, but the state does not have the power to veto that. And part of what this bill does as it came out of the House is to require that the state, the prosecution, assent to the civil compromise. That is not current law, and it would be a new provision.
And there are the two different provisions, Matt. Chairman Bright, members of the committee, the one thing I want to make clear is that imagine a situation where you are involved in some accident or some activity, and the person offers to pay you for that. You know, that you get into it, your neighbor gets mad at you and comes over and breaks your window, and then says, "Here's $50 for the broken window," and you take the $50, and then you realize later that you've compromised your right to prosecute him for breaking your window and trespassing on your property. The one key thing with the civil compromise is that the victim knowingly and intelligently makes the decision to take money and forego a criminal prosecution.
Yes, I'm turning this over to Courtney. I need to attempt it.
I just have one point that Honorable Counsel just brought up, and that is requiring the state to assent to a civil compromise, and I think they do understand the difference between what we're talking about, not the civil remedy, but the civil compromise. And current law says that the judge has to approve it, but it doesn't say that the prosecutor has to approve it. That's what the difference is.
Senator Burdick, Chairman Courtney and Senator Burdick, currently what happens is there's at least two people who have to agree, the defendant and the victim. Then they'd make that present that proposal to the judge to civilly compromise an offense. The state can agree to that or can object to it, and as Chairman Bryant pointed out, it's completely up to the court as to what the court will do. So even if all three parties agree to civilly compromise the matter, in theory the court can say, "I'm not going to accept the civil compromise."
So what this would do is it would give the state veto authority before it got to the judge. In other words, if the state didn't agree, it wouldn't even go to the judge.
Then it wouldn't even go to the judge.
What was the purpose of that amendment?
That was at, Mr. Horton is there. I think the philosophy was that sometimes the belief was that this was used as a way to sort of clean out dockets, and it wasn't always in the best interest. And we have the discretion to grant things in other cases and look at aggravating circumstances, whether or not they're appropriate. There are sometimes that victims, I think, quite frankly, rich defendants have an opportunity to offer them a lot of money, and they're more tempted to take the money than to follow through with the prosecution, which may or may not be in the public's best interest.
Thank you.
More questions? Thank you for your testimony. Ann, do you want to come forward? I know she moved school.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Christian. I'm Director of Indigent Defense Services Division. I'm here on behalf of the Judicial Department, which is neutral on the Ann Gross bill. The Judicial Department, specifically Indigent Defense, does have proposed a -A5 amendment. -A5 amendments address an issue that, quite frankly, is we view it as a housekeeping matter. Last session, there was a comprehensive reform of recovery of indigent defense costs. It was House Bill 2272. And that reform, in part, provided that anyone who is provided court-appointed counsel or counsel at state expense provided they have, and the court determines there's an ability to repay all or some of those costs, that everyone would be ordered to repay those costs. Previous law restricted recovery of indigent defense costs only in criminal cases, and of criminal cases only in those in which a defendant was convicted. So last session, ORS 151-505 was created, which provides for recovery of indigent defense costs in every single case. After House Bill 2462 was first heard in House Judiciary, a judge brought to my attention what appears to be a conflict in current law. And that conflict is with the revision to indigent defense recovery. In the last section, subsection of 135.705, it provides that costs do not include indigent defense costs. Our -A5 amendments would provide that those costs are included, and I do need to make it very clear for the record that in the wording of the proposed amendment, including costs under ORS 151.505, a subsection of that current statute expressly provides that an individual who does not have the ability to repay those costs may not be ordered to repay those costs.
And are the district attorneys okay with your amendment?
I know of no opposition to this proposed amendment.
I don't see heads nodding back there. Or
all right. Questions to this witness? This seems we can go to work session. No, we can't.
This is, Mr. Chairman, this is on for tomorrow.
All right, there you go. I can't. Ingrid, where are you going? You didn't sign up, Ingrid.
Chair, it's true I did not. I did send a note to the
chair.
To the chair requesting.
He must not have asked your note because he didn't.
He must not have, but since he's gone, maybe he'll ask.
Yeah, I'm writing your name here in red ink, but I write the witness's name in red ink.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I call Ingrid by her first name, please?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. Ingrid, did you get permission for us to use your first name? Now, this is important because a while ago, you know, I was trying to be a good vice chair. I'm going to try and set the record straight if I can. You did.
I'm sorry, Mr. Vice Chair. I just couldn't resist that thing.
Please proceed, Ingrid, with your testimony on House Bill 2807. No, that's not right.
No.
That's
2462.
I know. I'm already to the next bill.
And
on 2462A.
And Mr. Chair, the reason I hadn't signed up was I frankly understood that the VA consent language was to be withdrawn. There are A4 amendments here. I'm not sure whose they are, but I would ask the committee to consider the A4 amendments. It's my understanding that the district attorneys were not asking for this veto power, and it was sort of given to them over in the House. And my concern is this. Basically, the appropriate decision is with the court, and although the defendant may very much want a civil compromise and the victim may very much want a civil compromise, the court can deny that. And the district attorney is always a participant in this discussion, and if there are valid policy reasons for not dismissing it, you can bet that those are going to be heard. Frankly, we don't get a lot of civil compromises. And if the district attorney is opposed, and there's a good reason for it, we very likely are not going to get it. But to offer them a veto power when public policy reasons might dictate that a civil compromise is appropriate in this case might also not be advisable to them.
Third round.
Are you saying that if a victim agrees with the compromise, the state has the power to overturn the victim's request?
If you pass the language that's currently in the engrossed version, that is correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? So thank you very much, Ingrid.
Thank you.
Close the hearing on House Bill 2462A engrossed. Why is the Senator from Channel 6 here?
I've seen that you were chairing the committee and
meeting some
comic relief
compassion. I see. House Bill, open public hearing, House Bill 2807A. Also, while they're approaching the witness and the state police, Officer Kent Strickland, would you please come forward, please, to talk to us about this bill? Is there something wrong?
That's what the chairman said.
All right. Close that public hearing, quick. What else? Anything else?
That is innocent.
Also, why are you in the audience, Timothy Travis? Why are you here? Because I'm not real pleased to see you in the audience at all at any time since you came to took over the Eastern Division of the American League. All right, anything else to come before the committee? Because otherwise it's over. When that scandal goes down, it's over today.
Down.